The Early Learning and Elementary Education Subcommittee will now come to order. Members, for the roll call, please remember to turn on your microphones. Kirsten, please call the roll.
Chair Lupus. Vice Chair Coster.
Here.
Ranking Member Davis.
Here.
Representative Caruso.
Here.
Representative DeSegli.
Here.
Representative Duggan. Representative Hawkins.
Here.
Representative Hunchowski.
Here.
Representative Lamarca.
Here.
Representative Learned.
Here.
Representative McCurdy.
Here.
Representative Mooney.
Here.
Representative Nixon.
Here.
Representative Roach.
Present.
Representative Rodriguez. Representative Tribolsi.
Here.
Representative Trunow.
Here.
Representative Williams.
Here.
Mr. Chair, we have a quorum.
Thank you, Kirsten. Let the record show that a quorum is present. Members, please remember to silence all electronic devices and be recognized by the chair before addressing the committee or the presenters. Members, there's a rumor circulating around the Capitol that I may or may not have cried on the floor last year. It can be confirmed on the Florida Channel, and those tears were shed because of the bill we're going to talk about today, HB 419. I say this in all seriousness. There has not been a bill as transformational in the early childhood space in the last 20 years as HB 419, and it is a testament to the leadership of Representative Grawl and her commitment to this issue, to Speaker Sprouls and his commitment, as well as Chair Latvala. And just so you understand, and I said this last year, this will be and was perhaps one of the most important bills that you will vote on in your time in the Florida House, because what HB 419 did was literally transform our early learning system, allowing us to look at our youngest children and tell them that we are going to give them the foundation that they need to thrive. So today, the Department of Education, the Association of Early Learning Coalitions, and the Palm Beach School District are here to provide updates on the implementation of HB 419. And from the department, we have the new chancellor, the first chancellor ever of the Division of Early Learning, Mr. Matt Mears. Good to have you, Chancellor. As well as Juan Copa, who's the Deputy Commissioner for Accountability, Research, and Measurement. So, gentlemen, you are recognized to make your presentation.
Thank you, Chair Lupus, Vice Chair Coster, members of the committee. It's my honor to provide the very first legislative presentation in my lifetime. So I'm excited and a little bit nervous to have this privilege of presenting today. And as the new Chancellor of Early Learning, I want to say, as someone new to this space, some heroes that I've gotten to meet, and many of you know well, throughout this pandemic are our early learning providers and our early learning professionals. And I know it's well known by this committee, but during the most uncertain times of the pandemic, they stayed open and actually open their doors to the first responders so that they could be on the front lines when there were so many question marks, so many unknowns, so many fears that could have kept lesser people from stepping up. But guess what? They knew that the work they were doing was central. They opened their doors, and I wasn't the chancellor then, but I just want to take a moment and recognize that heroic effort that made everything else possible and the strength of Florida's recovery. When that is celebrated, our early learning professionals, the 30 early learning coalitions, and all of our providers across the state, I'm just so proud of what they accomplished and wanted to take a minute just to give them a shout out and to let them know how much I admire their work. The presentation we have before you today is focused on, as Chair Lupus said, the most transformational bill in early learning in Florida in the last two decades. And as you might imagine, a bill that's transformational touches a lot of different areas of our system. My best effort to sum it up in a couple of words is really high quality. I think all of these, yes, there's a service going on, but what makes that service transformational is the quality, the elements of quality. All these pieces, and I'll draw that out every place I can as we run through them, but I think the common denominator is Florida is embracing high quality and moving boldly toward that. And of course, that's going to mean, as we see through the progress monitoring piece, just like when we first began the A-plus plan, one of the things the A-plus plan did was when you had a statewide test, it's like coming in with a flashlight. Every dark corner that nobody even knew about, all of a sudden, there's pockets of need. That allows then the system to see how to focus efforts. Otherwise, you know, it's all just kind of reactionary. But when there's a statewide sort of snapshot, we get to see what's working, what's challenging. And so this is going to be transformational, and it's going to be like a journey up a mountain. As we step by step get this information, we'll only achieve high quality if we act on it. And I can tell you, the Division of Early Learning, our passion is we want to make every decision thinking about what's best for the children, what's best for Florida families. Our system doesn't exist to support early learning coalitions, the Division of Early Learning providers. We all exist to serve families and to put kids first, and that's what we want to do every day. So I'd like to run through these highlights, kind of we put it into categories quickly along the way, certainly if you have questions, and at the end we'll have time for questions as well. So the DEL governance piece, as Chair Lupus alluded to, it used to be there was the Office of Early Learning, which was kind of, we called it a dotted line to the Department of Education, and the office was headed up by a director. Now it's a division of the Department of Education. So we have this seamless 0 through 12, instead of K through 12, it's early learning through 12 system of education, and recognizing that and aligning that system is in itself just a wow moment, because with that alignment, there's so much more that we can do. And so, as a Division of Early Learning, that gives me the privilege of being the Chancellor of the Division of Early Learning. And as someone who's spent like the last 20 years as the law, the most recent 6.5 as the General Counsel, I can just tell you that this is an absolute dream come true. Like, this is the most important work that I can imagine ever doing, and it's actually far beyond my wildest dreams to be able to use my time and effort to help early learners, because I believe if you could choose anywhere in the spectrum to make an investment, early learning is the place where that investment is most impactful. And if you don't take my word for it, take it from Nobel laureate Professor Heckman out of the University of Chicago, who has shown the return on investment for this early learning space is more impactful than K-12 and colleges, than sort of any other program, because everything you want more of, like high school graduation, kindergarten readiness, third grade reading proficiency, success in the workforce, success in relationships, positive health outcomes, everything you want more of comes when we get early learning right. And everything you want less of also comes when you get early learning right. Fewer repeated grades, fewer high school dropouts, fewer students that end up in the DJJ and criminal justice system, more success in the workforce. So this committee's landmark investment is setting the stage to take Florida to the next level. And that's why the business community is prioritizing early learning, because this is going to give us the workforce that we need. We're now part of the system. We have a direct line to the State Board of Education, the commissioner, and we are an educational and high-quality care component of the education system, which is very exciting. The next piece we're going to talk about is the Gold Seal Program. The Gold Seal Program was housed under the Department of Children and Families, and DCF does the licensure and focuses on a health safety piece. What this does in bringing this over to the Department of Education is to focus on the education components and the accreditation to do that. And so as part of this, we're going to have an entirely new, based on national best practices, criteria for an entity to be able to offer accreditation. So there's existing entities now that are approved for accreditation. Those things stay in place, but the department is working with the sort of the gold standard national best practices to develop a new set of criteria, so there will be any accrediting entity is going to have to be approved by the Department of Education, and then those accrediting bodies will then approve providers. And what we want to do is make sure that the gold seal stands for something, and that is high quality. You don't want to walk into a gold seal center and say, well, how did they get accredited? It doesn't look high quality. You want to walk in and say, wow, this is what high quality looks like, and be impressed. And that's what we want to see through the gold seal program as it's implemented. Now, in terms of just getting there's two rules that are being implemented here, but to give you an idea of how transformational it is, there's 30 rules that are in the pipeline being changed, because essentially it's changing everything we do, this alignment with into the Department of Education, the alignment around quality. And so just an example of that, there's the two major gold seal rules are now being revised, and we expect to bring those up on the state board agenda in February. There's a meeting next week, and I think there's 4 early learning rules on that agenda, so we are moving ahead, but there's 30 in this pipeline of transformation. Now, this VPK accountability and program assessments, this is perhaps the most exciting and impactful area of change, because in the school readiness space, which is one of our major early learning components for the working poor, providing those services, the VPK, which is in the Florida Constitution, is a state-funded program for 4-year-olds. There has not been, there's the Flickers test is in place now, and that's traditionally when a kindergarten student enters, they take the test, and we look back and estimate how the VPK program, its quality. The class test looks at the interaction between the adults and the children, and based on that, assesses the quality of the program. And what research has shown is that it is those adult-child interactions that drive quality. And so what we're doing with the entire VPK system, which again, there was nobody looking at these interactions, which are like sort of the most important thing, and that nationally recognized assessment that's been successfully implemented in our school readiness program is now going to be used in the VPK space. So that's going to be an incredibly important step forward, and that training to get ready for that starts now, and by the fall, all VPK programs will be able to be assessed through the class assessment, and that will give parents a very important quality measure that they can look at when they're choosing a VPK program. The accountability, Mr. Coppa will be talking about this in a moment, but in addition to that class piece, which is going to be half of the assessment, there's also going to be the coordinated screening and progress monitoring. So that will give a snapshot along the way, the beginning of the year, the middle of the year, the end of the year. So instead of sort of waiting until VPK is over, the child spent a summer and then starts in a public school system in kindergarten, we're going to find out, like right when they enter VPK, kind of where they're at, how's it going. Then we'll get a mid-year, then we'll get an end-year, and we'll have a class score looking at the whole quality of the interaction. So it's just, it's like 10x better. It's really going to give a lot more real-time information. There's going to be a feedback loop that allows for not waiting until it's too late and thought, oh, I wish we would have seen that Susie was so behind. We could have, you know, we didn't realize that. No, we're going to find that out early so that programs can be customized as they're moving through the VPK program. And we're also going to be providing training. If a center has a class score that's not what it needs to be, guess what? They won't be able to contract with us, because a child can't, you know, go through their 4-year-old life a second time, right? We've got to make sure that the adults are ready to meet those needs the first time through. The coalition governance, I touched on this, but instead of being a dotted line, we are part of the Department of Education with a direct line to the commissioner, to the state board, and that includes as I mentioned before, there's 30 early learning coalitions, and those early learning coalitions are also part of that system that will report to the department and the state board as well. So it's like we're all kind of taking this step to say, yes, we're going to hold ourselves to some very high standards because this work is so important. One component of that, and this is, again, we are leaning into this because all of the early learning team, as I've gone around the state and have met with people, People are passionate about this work. They care. And when you talk to the people that are answering the phones, that when a parent is calling in for help, they want to make sure that that when the parent hangs up the phone, they got the help they needed. Somebody was patient. Somebody listened. Someone pointed them to resources. And one thing that's going to help all of us is this customer service survey. And so we're going to partner with a major university that does this type of work, develop a survey, and it's going to give us wonderful insight around the state as to how satisfied are the customers we're serving. Like every big company wants that, right? Well, we want to hold ourselves to that standard, and we're not going to be satisfied if it's just above the threshold. Like, okay, we made it. We're at 60% or something. We want to be like, I'm 98, but I'm not happy with that because I want everybody that hangs up. I want to get to 99, so I can just assure you that whatever the cutoff is, the conversation with the ELCs is going to be, where are you at now and how can you get better until everybody has given us, you know, 5 stars worth of just, you know, you guys are totally awesome, because that's the level of service we want to provide. The early learning providers, some of these things, again, we kind of touched on the gold seal, the VPK training, again, the voluntary pre-kindergarten training. Part of this is in order to do the class assessment, there's roughly 12,800 VPK classrooms across the state. And so to have observations, to have someone go in and use this class tool, they have to come in and observe the adult-child interactions. So that's a lot to ramp up to. And the Division of Early Learning is working with the Early Learning Coalitions to ramp up, so we're ready for that. But this is like a major effort, and 419 sets the stage for us to be able to do that. Now, of course, we're updating the contracts that we have with providers to meet all these new requirements. And I just want to tell you about one, because, again, under that theme of high quality, you might have heard of contracted slots, like, well, we need contracted slots. Let me tell you why that is so important, and that's one of the things that's enhanced through 419. As an early learning coalition, many times there's hundreds of providers in some of the larger coalitions. You know, Miami-Dade, there might be 700-800. There's, in the course of any given day, month, week, there's going to be some vulnerable students that come into that center, some through DCF, like through the foster care. The court has to intervene. A child is taken from an unsafe situation. What we want to do is put those children in the absolute highest quality we can. Well, guess what you and I know about high-quality centers? They have waiting lists, right? How do you get in there? Like, you can't just take the kid that showed up yesterday, move him to the front of the line. You know, how would that be fair? What the contracted slots allows you to do is the Early Learning Coalition can get with the high-quality provider who has a long waiting list and say, you know, you do such good work here. Could you have 3 or 4 slots that you hold for special vulnerable students, like when they come available, so that they show up on our doorstep one day and the next day they're in like the best place in the county? Well, the contracted slots is what makes that happen, because essentially it allows a high quality provider to hold some slots, and then when a student comes up, there's a space there. It's almost like, we're sorry you're going through a tough time, but guess what? We've prepared for you, and we're going to give you the best care we can to help lower the levels of toxic stress and put that child in that environment where they can begin to then flourish and thrive. So that's just one example. But so when you say, you know, update the contracts, it's provisions like that that lead to high quality that, as Chair Lupa said, that is transformational. When we can have a system that anticipates critical needs that unfortunately happen every day and builds into the system a way to get vulnerable students access to high quality. And that's something we think about and dream about every day, is making sure that every child has access to a high quality system. So here's the other piece that's really exciting, and that is 419 has raised the expectations we have on the adults in the system. And as I said at the beginning, I have incredible admiration and respect for the adults in the system. The work they are doing and the work they have done is amazing. They care about children, and many of them could go to some other profession and make more. You know, Broward County, the Amazon warehouse starts you out at $18 an hour with benefits and free college. But why are we raising expectations for the adults in the system? Because that's the only way we're going to get to high quality, and because the adults in the system want to deliver high quality. So we used to have all lead VPK teachers take one emergent literacy course. We're going from one course, which is good and important, to now three courses. So this is, you know, may not be ultimately where we land, but to have the entire workforce, that all 13,000 of those VPK classrooms are going to have a teacher who has, in most cases, likely just right fresh on their mind, recently completed three emergent literacy courses. And this is aligned to get us ready for kindergarten readiness, but also third grade reading. Because as many of, as you know, these emergent literacy courses, like, it's the phonemic awareness, it's the sounds. Children learn to speak, but speech is just, it's not separate words, it all kind of all runs together, and the emergent literacy is beginning to train that child's ear, that phonemic awareness, so you start can take words apart and do rhyming words and the letter sounds. And when I used to pick my niece up from her VPK on the way home, we would go through the alphabet and we would go back and forth on like words that begin with that first sound. So we'd, you know, bus and butterfly and butter and just whatever we saw out the window would trigger. And so that's the kind of work that will come out of this emergent literacy training. And now I'm going to hand it over because Mr. Juan Copa is going to talk about the coordinated screening and progress monitoring system, which dovetails into this whole, again, movement to elevate our system.
Thank you, Chancellor Mears, Chair Lupus, members of the committee. Good morning. My name is Juan Copa, Deputy Commissioner for Accountability, Research, and Measurement at the Department of Education. And I will close today's presentation with a brief overview of VPK through grade 8 progress monitoring. House Bill 419 created a VPK through grade 3 coordinated screening and progress monitoring system in English language arts and mathematics. State law now requires the Commissioner of Education, in coordination with the Council on Early Grade Success, develop a plan to implement the system in consideration of the timelines of implementing new content standards. Briefly, some background on the standards. In response to Governor DeSantis's charge to eliminate Common Core in Florida's classrooms, in 2020, the State Board of Education adopted new K-12 English Language Arts and Mathematics standards, named the Benchmarks for Excellent Student Thinking, or BEST, fully aligned curriculum, instructional materials, and assessments will be in place for the 2022-2023 school year, which is when, by law, the coordinated screening and progress monitoring system must be in place. In addition to House Bill 419, House Bill 7011 from the last legislative session required the department to procure the coordinated screening and progress monitoring system and expanded it to cover VPK through grade 8. House Bill 419 called upon the Council for Early Grade Success to review any procurement solicitation documents and criteria prior to their publication. Following the appointment of members, the council met for the first time 2 weeks ago to review the invitation to negotiate, or ITN document for the progress monitoring system, again, before its publication. Feedback from the council was used to improve and strengthen the ITN before it was published last week on October 6th. For example, the key role that early learning coalitions will play in the implementation of this system across thousands of non-public VPK providers as it relates to training, communication, and support for test administration was explicitly clarified in the ITN thanks to that feedback. I'd like to thank all council members, including your colleague, Representative Aaron Grawl, who serves on that council, for their very thorough review. It helped the ITN become a stronger document. The next slide outlines the requirements of regarding what the coordinated screening and progress monitoring system must do. Among the requirements, it must be a valid, reliable, and developmentally appropriate system or instrument. It must measure student progress. Chancellor Mears alluded to the ability now to have data not only on an annual snapshot basis, but across within the school year, up to three times a year, and across that continuum from VPK all the way through grade eight. So the system must measure that progress in English, language, arts, and mathematics. Additionally, data from the system must be used for VPK program accountability, as alluded to earlier in this presentation. Bottom line, all the required components that are stated in the law that the system must do, their primary purpose is to improve student outcomes, and that's really the bottom line of all this great work. As you can see from this slide, the procurement of these services is a multi-step process. We have reached a major milestone in the publication of the ITN last week, October 6th. It is scheduled to close 7 weeks from that date, so that's November 17th. And we anticipate a contract in place by the spring, early spring, so that training can occur in spring and summer, so that that system, the new coordinated system across VPK through grade eight as required in state law, is in place beginning at the start of next school year. And with that, that concludes the presentation. Chancellor Mears and I are happy to address any questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Cooper. Thank you, Chancellor Mears. Members, questions? Representative Learned, you're recognized.
Thank you. And Mr. Cooper, my question's for you. If you can go back to slide 20 real quick. My question, I own a small tutoring center, and I tutor kids from three all the way through SAT test prep. And it just caught my eye. So I think I understood this from the chancellor's question, but if we're not expecting VPK kids, four-year-olds, to be reading, how are we differentiating the standards for a VPK versus the K-8 traditional schools?
You're recognized.
Thank you, Chair Lupus. The standards I alluded to, the best standards, that you're correct. Those are for K-12. I'll look to the chancellor for assistance on this, but there are, I don't know the name of the standards, but there are specific standards that related to grades, ages four and above the VPK period. It's key, again, with this coordinated system, because the goal is, of course, to, as Chancellor Mears mentioned, those early interventions as early as possible, so that students are reading by grade three, because we've been measuring student progress on an annual basis for over 20 years. We can look at data across time. And what you clearly see is that if a student is not reading on grade level by grade three, more than likely they are not reading on grade level. It's upwards of 80% of students. If they score that level one or level two in third grade, by the time they're in 10th grade, they're still scoring. 80% of them are still scoring level one or level two, which then impacts graduation rates, which then of course impacts post-schooling outcomes in terms of careers, et cetera. So the interventions are key, the coordination is key. We've adopted new standards in K through 12, and this system of measurement is just one piece of that puzzle, making sure there is alignment between what is being taught in that is developmentally appropriate in the VPK area translates and is useful to improve those student outcomes once they enter the K through 12 system.
You recognize
the Florida Early Learning Standards.
You recognize.
Thank you. So, I love where we're going with this. I'm a huge supporter. This is awesome. I guess just as a quick follow up. So the standard is not that a 4 year old is required to read, right? Like where are we saying that a child? When is it? When do we want kids to be reading under this new standard?
Thank you, Chair Lupus. I think the goal again is to get students to be on grade reading at on grade level or above by the third grade. So it's building those skills so that we see that performance by the conclusion of third grade is really a strong predictor of future outcomes beyond that. Basically, students are learning to read up to that point. And then post grade three, they're reading to learn. So again, it's not that we expect all students to be able to read at age four, but they should be acquiring those necessary skills so that by the third grade, students are reading on grade level and above.
Final.
You're recognized.
Thank you for that. And I guess maybe I'm just getting way too into the weeds on it, and so I apologize. Maybe we could follow up. I would love to just see kind of where those early benchmark standards are. I think all of us, you know, have had some PTSD related to high stakes testing in the past, and we don't want to see that pushed down on the young kids. And I just want to make sure that we're getting kids on level to read. But if we're creating new accountability standards for VPK and reading is not the standard, then we are using something. And I'd like to know what that something is really what I'm getting.
And I think Chancellor Mears and Chancellor Oliva in the K-12 area would be happy to follow up as well.
Thank you.
Ranking Member Davis, you're recognized.
Thank you, Chair. Mr. Copeland, my questions are for Chancellor Mears, but thank you.
Thank you.
Hi, Chancellor Mears. First of all, let me just make a comment. Just listening to you in this presentation took me back to my days in the classroom, because I could see your personal investment and I can see your excitement about this program for 419, as well as your excitement for your new position. So thank you for all of that. You inspired me before I start asking my questions. But you talked about the emergent literacy courses and going from one emergent course to three emergent courses. So I was just wondering, is there a cost for the individuals taking the courses, or is that something that's built in and absorbed somewhere?
You're recognized.
Great question. And the Division of Early Learning and the department are just about to release a guidance document to lay this out. But there's 10 courses that have been identified. Some of the courses that are on the DCF learning management system, there's a $10 cost. I think there's two or three of those. All the rest are free. Representative Davis, where my head has been going with this, with some of the federal relief funds, you know, I'm thinking we should be celebrating each time someone who has a full-time job, you know, maybe making $12, $13 an hour without benefits, is now doing a work requirement on their, you know, that's a big commitment. And with 12,000 classrooms, that's a lot of people. So what I want to do is like do what the parents do when their kids are in Little League, right? They're right there cheering them on, like, you can do it, you know, swing that bat, you know? So I want to be like right by them, like saying, okay, this, I know there's a lot of pressures in your life. And so part of what I hope we can do is find a way to recognize as they go from one class to two to three, perhaps with some completion, you know, or like a recognition. That's not in place. That's just, you know, my idea. But where I think I hear you going is this is a heavy lift to go from one required five-hour course to now. That's a lot more hours to find to what somebody might be a single mom working. Maybe they're balancing a couple jobs even. And so I would just say we really are aware that there's already a lot on the system and on the providers and on the employees, and we want to set them up for success. So the cost at most would be $10 for the class, and my thinking is that, yes, in addition to that, we should be celebrating and recognizing. So I would love to see when somebody successfully completes a course that we have a way to take some of the relief dollars, which are meant to enhance the quality in the classroom. So it's like, boom, this is exactly what we're doing, to use some of those funds so that they'll be like, wow, not only did I learn a lot, I'm going to be all set to do my, you know, Christmas shopping, or I can pay that bill, or I can have an extra little bit of money as an emergency fund. So I think with the funds that are in the pipeline, I think we'll be able to really, celebrate those successes But I do agree it's going to be hard, and putting myself in their shoes to think of doing this, I'm sure it will feel overwhelming, and that's why I hope we can have the You Can Do It cheering squad that I want to head up to make sure we all get across the finish line. And because really, with 70,000 early learning professionals in our workforce, my dream is how can we be on this path of continuous improvement together so that you come into the system, you know, with the required credentials, but then every day you're getting better at your craft because you're not an employee, you're an early learning professional. And guess what? All of us that have the privilege of working with children, that's the most important work we'll ever do. And so when we start to convey that, like, respect for them, and because many of them don't realize, they might view it as a job, but it's changing the trajectory of lives when you provide high-quality care. So I really, while we give them the skills, I want to also help them to see how impactful they are and find every way possible to celebrate and recognize that skill development in our workforce. Sorry to be so long-winded.
You're recognized.
No, I promise you, you're about to gain another teacher because I'm about to come back to the classroom. And the last question I wanted to talk to you about, you talked about the customer service survey. Could you kind of just describe that for us? Potentially, what is the data you're looking for? Maybe the services, the percentages. You talked about it a little bit, but just kind of give us a visual for that one.
So the customer service survey, one of the things the statute lays out is it has to be a statistically significant sampling type survey. And I readily admit the Division of Early Learning, certainly I don't have the expertise to know how to measure it, but the 419 provides that the survey will be to the parents, and it's the customer referral network. So when people are calling in, those contacts are traced. Some number of those will be surveyed, but also there'll be surveys of the Early Learning Coalition board and of the Early Learning Coalition itself, right? And I think there's one other group. Oh, there it is right there. Families, providers, and ELC board members. So what I know needs to happen is of these groups, we're going to sample enough to then be able to estimate from that sample, like the entire population, like you would poll 1,000 people and do, you know, say what the whole state is thinking. So, but it's going to be for each early learning coalition, there'll have to be a survey administered to these three groups. Those three groups, and the law leaves a lot of flexibility, and I think it's good because we're going to lean on the experts, the research universities that design these surveys, to help us to calibrate this so it's a fair measure, because it is it's a snapshot, but it's a snapshot that can have consequences if an early learning coalition does not meet the bar. So those three groups will be surveyed. It'll be a big enough sample to be able to sort of calibrate and make a determination about how the whole system is performing.
Representative Caruso.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Chancellor Mears and Deputy Commissioner Coppa, for your presentation. Very good this morning. You mentioned Susie in VPK earlier today, and if she was assessed as being deficient in the language arts or mathematics, will she subsequently receive specialized instruction or otherwise to bring her up to speed? And if so, could you give an example of how she would be picked out and given special attention to bring her up to speed on her reading or math skills? Yeah.
Well, and I think what you've touched on is sort of the core of the mission of the Council for Early Grade Success, because they've been charged with, as these assessments are administered, they're actually going to be diving into the data and looking for those pockets. And I think, you know, the great thing about the data is it gives us a window into the needs. And I think the programs, those intervention programs, have not yet been designed, but they will be possible for the first time, because now, instead of just not knowing or just kind of going on instincts or our own, you know, subjective judgment, we'll have an objective snapshot. And so as the Chancellor of Early Learning, the answer is absolutely, we are going to be expecting and working with our early learning coalitions and providers so that when there are, just like they triage at a hospital, right, if somebody walks in and they got a scratch, you can, you know, we're not worried about it, but if it's a cardiac arrest, we get five adults in the room in a hurry, and we're moving in to save that life and minimize the damage. So every time we see a child behind, my goal is that we provide a plan of action with additional services and support so they can catch up. And of course, the good news is when they're 4 years old, they haven't fallen that far behind, right? So let's catch them up early so then they're ready by kindergarten, and then the teacher there can build on that early preparation to propel them to the third grade reading proficiency. But it's kind of being sorted out. We don't have any specific plans in place to intervene, but it'll all now be possible because of this progress monitoring work.
I just want to say I also share your excitement for the possibilities to come for our children's education, and I want to thank you. No further.
Representative Hawkins, you recognize?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First of all, thank you for being here and for the presentation. It was incredible legislation. I think it'll be a national standard one day others will look at. I want to focus on when you talked about program customization. Rep. Koster had a bill last year that talked about closing the achievement gap, and I serve on that task force. And I think it'd be very important for the two groups to get together after what I'm going to ask you. We know that coming out of VPK, going into kindergarten, males are already 4% behind the females. Are you going to customize programs toward the gender learning to make sure males, we know males are learning different than the females, but how do we keep them on grade level? Is that something you guys are looking at now, or will that just have to play out throughout this bill?
You recognize me.
Thank you, Chair. Yes, and I think the work that you're doing is certainly going to inform those kinds of interventions. But that's exactly when we talk about having a skilled workforce, to have the 70,000 early learning professionals being able to tailor their instruction to understand that the young boys may have different learning needs or different techniques or approaches that are more effective, and being able to recognize that and absolutely eliminate those gaps. And I think this early learning space and this coordinated screening and progress monitoring is the can be the most powerful way that we can begin to meaningfully obliterate the achievement gaps. Because that's, don't let someone fall behind and try to catch them up. Never let them fall behind is, instead of no child, you know, let's bring them along. And I think recognizing those differences, those subtleties, this is the exact kind of thing we can look at with this progress monitoring tool. We can look for those gaps and address them like before they become systematic and significant.
Chair, just one
real quick representative.
If we could get those two groups together, I think now, and be working on that even for one meeting, to share what we're learning, and when it comes to whether the curriculum that's being taught or the interaction, I think it'd be great. So thank you.
Members, we have 8 more minutes for this portion of the meeting, and I have 4 more representatives with questions. So next is Representative Hunchofsky.
Thank you, Chair Alupas. And before I direct my question, Chair Alupas, earlier you mentioned everybody who was involved in this, but you didn't really mention yourself. And I just wanted to thank you for your dedication and passion to early learning. It is incredibly infectious throughout this whole committee, and I just want to say thank you for your efforts on that. And with that, I will turn to Chancellor Mears, thank you so much, and I concur with what Ranking Member Davis said. As somebody who has never been a teacher, I admire the people who have the dedication to do this, and your enthusiasm for this and your passion for this is incredibly clear throughout your presentation. I think this is an amazing bill. I'm so honored that I was able to be here to vote for it. But one of the concerns I have was actually something that you mentioned about the $18 that you receive when you go and work for Amazon. And while I understand that this is wonderful work, the early learning professionals are literally changing the world in the work they do, it seems unfair that they're asked to sacrifice in the process. And I can tell by the way you were talking, you share those concerns. And I just wanted to ask, what is being done? I know that there's been funding available that hasn't been dispersed yet. What is being done to make sure that they are getting properly compensated in order to implement all of these wonderful standards?
You recognize.
Thank you, Chair. The good news is that the federal relief dollars are specifically designed to, it's called the stabilization fund. So one of the ways the system could be stabilized is through additional funding, including premium pay opportunities or retention bonuses. So the great news is, in the short term, now of course these are one-time dollars, there's resources for that, and I can just assure you that the Division of Early Learning and myself, we're working closely with all stakeholders with an incredible sense of urgency to get those funds out the door so they can be drawn down by each of the providers across the state and used. And I agree with you that one of the number one needs I hear about is the workforce, because coming out of the economy with so much competition for those workers, it's something that needs to be addressed. And I have great confidence in our leadership here in Florida, the governor, the commissioner of education, our House and Senate leaders, that those needs are going to be recognized and addressed with the commitment that they have for this bill, because obviously high quality is the goal, and what you mentioned is a component of getting there. And so I will be a partner in all those conversations to move Florida forward, both with the temporary federal funds, but also finding the additional resources in order to continue to lift the early learning profession and to be able to attract and retain those workers. So you've raised a great issue, and I'm just a partner in all those conversations to make that happen.
I appreciate that so much. Thank you.
Representative Tribolsi.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Counselor. I have to say the future is bright for Florida students, and have five grandchildren under the age of four and one on the way, so I am excited for them to be under your leadership. So thank you so much. My question for you is, I was in a workshop yesterday, and we talked about IEPs and grades K through 12. And from what I understood, IEPs, from the time of evaluation to the time of implementation, can sometimes take a year, which is a year lost in a child's education and moving forward. And not to put anything else on your plate, and maybe it's already built into here, I don't know. But since the majority of these children in this VPK system will be going to the public schools and are in their own area, is there a way to, since you're going to be identifying so closely with these children three times a year, to possibly identify children with, certain disabilities that would fall and maybe they would need an IEP going into their K through 12 years, so that evaluation process could start ahead of time and we could get ahead of the curve?
You recognize.
Thank you, Chair. Just a quick disclaimer, and that it's not an area I know everything about. I know just a tiny bit. I do know with an IEP, a student can be in the public school system with the regular FEFP funding starting at 3 years old. So if those special needs are identified, there's actually a very robust system to provide those early services. And yes, the great news is through this progress monitoring, one of the goals is to that the tool helps to identify things like learning difficulties that might need to be addressed. So that absolutely is a wonderful benefit of this. It's going to be early identification. And many of the early learning coalitions do screening of all the children, have that available. And so I just would say, yes, 100%, this is going to further those efforts. And I love working with the early coalitions to make sure that everything they have to do that screening is in place, because as you've suggested, the sooner we can get started to address those needs, somebody might be sort of treading water And once you take care of the issue, then they can begin to move forward and progress. So great question. And yes, this bill will help to address that.
Thank you so much.
Representative Nixon.
Thank you, Chair. And I want to echo some of my colleagues' sentiments and statements earlier. I'm excited. I have a 13-month-old, so it's exciting to have her coming up under your leadership. I have a question in regards to, you talked about the contract spots available for those who don't have access to a high-quality VPK program. Can you tell me, like, how is that pool of folks or kids identified? Is it going to be needs-based? I'm just really interested in it.
So that may be a separate conversation, in part because my knowledge is limited, so maybe we can follow up. And just the example I gave was an Early Learning Coalition talking about how they use contracted slots to help vulnerable students coming in through the child welfare system, so they're quickly placed and they can know that when that student does come out of a difficult situation, they have a spot for them rather than sort of, oh, now what are we going to do? And you start looking when they arrive rather than having the spot like ready and available. So I think there's not a set criteria, but the Early Learning Coalition I talked with just started with their most vulnerable and made it a priority for them. And I think that could be expanded because, of course, all of our children need a spot in a high-quality learning center. It's not just our vulnerable students. And so when we can really take a victory lap is when every one of our centers is that high-quality center that is going to do a great job. And so at the same time, those that have just come through a traumatic situation, we want to, in every way possible, give them the best of the best without any kind of delays, jumping through hoops, sorry, there's a waiting list, we can't get you till next week, and kind of leaving a child in limbo when they're already going through something very challenging. So if it's okay, maybe we could just follow up to give you additional information that we can get from the Early Learning Coalition Association about how they're using those contracted slots and maybe let you talk to a couple of people that are implementing that because it's strongly supported as a real game changer for the system.
And Representative Mooney's gonna close us out.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's short, I promise. So former teacher myself, and when you touched on coaching and how we cheer kids on, so I have a question. Anywhere in the plan, we're right now, it appears that we're thinking all kids are pretty much normal and that we're gonna teach them how to get going and we're gonna make it better for them down the road. We're gonna accelerate their education. Is there anything, any plans available or any plans to test hearing, vision, dyslexia? Because as a former coach, I had a kid that learned a very difficult scheme on my I was a defensive coach and a head coach, but I had a very complicated defense. And why this kid was held back and held back and held back over the course of years. And then one time, Bob Greasy decides that he's throwing interceptions. They can't find out. Bob Greasy gets his eyes tested, finds out he's not seeing very well. So I brought in an eye doctor, tested my team, and lo and behold, I had three kids couldn't see. Their parents couldn't buy them glasses. I bought them glasses. But meantime, they're now juniors and seniors. So if you let it get that far along, so if you don't have something in a plan for kids that don't have the ability and financial wherewithal to make sure that they can hear, they can see, because that obviously is going to drag down everything. And not only, you know, it doesn't just drag them down. It drags the entire pod down. It slows the teaching process down. It impacts students who want to learn more, but they can't because teachers struggle. So if there's anything in place, yes or no, and if not, I'd like you just to consider how you would do that. Thank you.
You're recognized, Chair, for the short question.
Thank you, Chair. We will... I've talked to an Early Learning Coalition where they do that screen for every child, the hearing, the vision, and that. I'll work with the Early Learning Association, and we'll get you data just so you can kind of get a snapshot of where that's happening. I think that's a wonderful initiative and 100% behind it. Yeah, very important.
Fantastic. Well, Deputy Commissioner Coppa and Chancellor Mears, I just want to personally thank both of you. Chancellor, you heard from our committee. I think everybody today saw your heart. And that's the thing that's been, I think, most inspiring for me, getting to know you over the last couple of months. You've been thrown into the deep end in this world, but you're swimming like Michael Phelps. And I share the same sentiments that you. There is no more important job that you need to be in than this role right now in the
the impact that you're going to have on countless children is going to be tremendous. So really, truly excited for you, and thank you again for being here with us today. Okay, members, we're moving on to our next presenter. We will hear from Aaron Smeltzer, who is the Executive Director of the Association of Early Learning Coalitions.
Good morning. I'm going to multitask and talk to you while I'm getting this ready. All right. So good morning, and one, thank you for caring enough to have this whole conversation around early learning. And Chair Lupus, I know you made a joke about crying last year, but from somebody who's been in this work for almost 20 years, seeing that moment and what Senator Harrell and Representative Grawl did last year to make this important to people really, I just don't have words to thank you for that. So thank you enough for caring about this and welcoming us here. We are incredibly excited about this bill. The coalitions obviously are just so excited to be in the space to be that bridge between the work being done and the state, as well as just being a part of seeing the story unfold where we not only, as Chancellor Mears mentioned, close the achievement gap, but also look at the opportunity gaps that we can close as well, because this is just such a comprehensive program in early learning that it's amazing what we can do. So thank you for caring about it so much. So first off, who are we? For those of you who don't know us, hopefully you all do. The early learning coalitions are all around the state. There are 30 of them. They have all unique service areas, some single counties, some multi-county, and we cover the entire state and make early learning available to anybody who would need access to it. We try our best to work with our stakeholders and our partners to build a comprehensive system for early learners. And we also make sure families know how to access anything, not just early learning, but resources and food, anything that they might need. We sit as that touch point for them to be able to make sure that they don't have trouble finding what they might need to be successful in life. So, as I mentioned, we were super excited about the new work and how we get to make new changes in our community. So what we did first was, obviously, it was 180 pages, so we were excited to dig in. We took every piece of change in the bill, and we wrote it out as a group and talked through these topics: capacity, training, contracts and form changes, rules, technology, how do we communicate it in a way that makes sense. And we worked with every single coalition in the state, from the frontline staff all the way to the executive director, to get every piece of feedback that we could, so that as we reported back to the division, and we have an incredible relationship and open dialogue with Chancellor Mears and his team, but we wanted to make sure that what we gave them was meaningful. So after that exercise, we came up with a few initial steps for implementation. The first thing that we looked at is, how do we build our ELC board and staff capacity? How can we make sure that early learning providers feel successful in implementing all of these new tasks? I love the mention of, how do we pay them for doing all this new work? Those were conversations that came up a lot. And then how do we look at our rules and our current policies and procedures to make sure that it actually covers these changes in a way that the frontline staff and providers and families experiencing these changes are successful? We also did a lot of digging in limited access areas. I'll go into all of these, so don't worry, I'm giving a real quick overview. And then really highlighted ELC and school district collaboration. So first, working with our board was our first step. Our boards are a critical role. They play a critical role in our communities to make sure that what we're doing meets the unique community needs. You can imagine what it looks like in Escambia County looks very different in Miami-Dade County and Monroe. And also just within every county in the state, we see really unique needs, which is where I think the coalitions excel in taking what's expected, but tailoring it to really meeting those unique challenges. So our board helps us govern that work. We gave them an overview of the new changes. We asked them to give us feedback on the guiding principles they wanted us to consider to keep that uniqueness in our community, and then asked them for best practices that they've seen. A lot of them have a really rich history, and you're hearing from one of the board members today that comes from a different angle to give us really good practices on implementation. Working with our staff, we started with doing a staffing analysis. We asked each team, if they were to implement each of the new changes, what would it take? How many members would it take to do it? What kinds of training would be needed? And we started working from there. We made sure that training was, we have a system that the division built within the state on the class tool that he mentioned, where we can actually train each other to build capacity. So we started that work. We have people all around the state from different counties sharing that practice or sharing that training so that it doesn't cost the state anything to build our own internal capacity. But we also worked to make sure that the people who would be on the field supporting the providers and the families knew exactly what was expected of them and also had the ability and the confidence to do it well. we asked for a cost analysis, so we're building that data right now just to see what is this going to cost at the local level to do the new changes, and we're going to give all of that back to the division just so they have a good look at any unexpected costs that may come up. And then also we worked on finding out what's already working well. So as was mentioned earlier, we had this bill pass in school readiness. So that has been implemented fully. We had a 5-year onboarding process for that. So we had a really good look at what it would take to get something like this built in one program. So we have done a lot of work to look at how we can move that into our other program, which is now, as Chair Lupus mentioned, building a really comprehensive look at the quality across all programs. Another thing we looked at, and you'll hear later from my colleague Diane, that we had a lot of coalitions who have done great work. And so we brought that work to the group and had them share it across the state. So Diana will tell you of her work with her colleague MJ and how they did that in Palm Beach, but tried to make sure that anything that was working well or had lessons learned, we ensured everyone across the state had that, so we didn't have to make our own mistakes, but really could learn from each other and excel quickly with things that have already been tried out. So part of what we did for our programs is we know as coalitions that we understand the work, but we aren't always in the day-to-day. Many of us have been classroom teachers and directors, and we know that part of it, but it looks different as things change. So we made sure that all of the early learning providers in the state had a really clear understanding of what was being asked of them and also the benefits of the program. I can't tell you how many people are so excited about the fact, as Chancellor Mears mentioned, we're going to know how those kids walk in the door. We really haven't had that before. So to be able to know how they came, if they came from a traumatic background and they're a few years behind, a few months behind, we're going to know that right off and be able to act accordingly and make sure that we see the growth in our programs. Providers really shared that sentiment a lot when we spoke with them. But the other place that we really wanted to work was making sure we had space for a feedback loop with our providers. So we had a lot of venues for that. We did face-to-face meetings with them. We did Facebook Lives. We did Zoom meetings. Just asking questions about what it would take to be successful. We got a ton of feedback, and we also asked them a lot, how will this look for your classroom? What kinds of impacts will this make? And a lot of what we heard, like I mentioned, was just excitement around new changes that really gave them credit for what they were doing. I know historically you might have known the system before, but we saw how they walked into kindergarten, had a few checkpoints before, but really this new system will take us to a place where we see how they come in, we see how the classroom interactions are going, and we see how they exit. So we're able to see the full story. And what that does, speaking from being an old provider, is they're not going to stress now when a kid comes in and shows up that they're maybe 6 months to a year behind their peers. We're going to be able to show the work that happened in that classroom without that provider being held accountable for something that maybe they couldn't fix in the short time that they had access to that child. So really, a lot of great feedback, just sending it back to the bill sponsors and the team that worked on this. I think it really is exciting to see that change with our providers. Some of the other impacts that came up is we really wanted to, they wanted to highlight that the workforce shortage is huge right now. So as we work through this, how do we make sure that we, again, back to the point mentioned earlier, address what's needed, but also address that they're struggling and that there's a lot going on right now from the COVID pandemic impacts. And so we want to make sure that whatever we create locally addresses that. And we also want to make sure that we're thinking about this from continuity. So what does this look like before they get to VPK? And how do we make sure to align both systems between what's happened in our school readiness program, what's going to be changing in VPK, and obviously with the new division changes, linking that really strongly with our K-12 system. One of the other things we did to support providers is we worked on training in the foundations of what we call program assessment and progress monitoring, but that just means how we collect data on children and how we interact in the classroom. We want to make sure that the providers understood that and knew how that measurement worked, and they understood why those measurements were important. So we did a lot of work on that. We also opened that up widely. I'll talk about that in a second. But we made sure that these trainings were available so no one felt surprised when next year we show up and we monitor them, not monitor them, but come out and do an observation and tell them what we saw in the classroom. We want to make sure that they knew what was coming on that. And then as we got that feedback, we also made sure that whatever they asked for, as much as we could make available, we made it available. We made online courses available. We created communities of practice at the local level so they could get together and talk and figure out, how do I do this? What's worked well? What hasn't worked well? A lot like what we did at the state level to find out from our peers what worked well. So we did a lot of that and made sure any research, any resources were available to them. This was my favorite part of the process, honestly, because I'm a policy nerd. I probably share that with many of you in this room. But we went through every rule that we could find that was relevant, and we're not done, but we have been working diligently to see what would need to change. what would need to be created, a new rule language, and have been very grateful for the division as they have opened that door to us to give really great feedback so that our rules and the how we do this work is created and developed in a very meaningful way that makes the impact that we think really is the intent of the law. So we've done that again. We worked with frontline staff to executive directors to make sure that everyone had feedback. It didn't matter what role you played. We wanted to know how this affected you. And then we have that all compiled. We've got a few of them done. We're still working on the rest of them and then plan to pass that along as they start their promulgation process. This is an area I think is really important because there are, to points that were mentioned earlier, areas of the state that don't have access to quality. They also don't have access to a lot of programs. And so what we've done as coalitions is looked internally at our data to identify those areas. So if an area was identified as an area that either had limited access to VPK or limited access to quality VPK, the coalitions have worked with their teams to go into those communities and provide really intensive technical assistance and intervention as much as they could. So we set everyone up for success in this process. And we don't want an area where a kid can't find a high quality program. And so that's always been our goal. We're doing ongoing recruitment for providers in those areas and early learning programs in those areas. And so we're going to continue that work while we also make sure to support the providers and their programs so they know how to implement these new regulations, but also feel confident in their practice. Another thing, this is the very last one that we've been highlighting. Again, this is an ongoing process. I'm happy to update you in 6 months when this has changed a bit. But the next part of our work has been looking at our school district collaboration with the coalitions. There's a lot of overlap in regulations, which we always have had, but this one is a little more clear. So what we've done, again, as you'll hear in a bit, is found out where it's working well, leveraged really strong partnerships to find out how they've worked with contacts, who's done what role, what kind of benefits we've learned, and we've shared that across the board. So everyone in the state has heard the stories from Palm Beach and other counties in the state where they've done this well. We also have opened up our trainings to our school district friends across the aisle in the K-12 world. And so we have opened up class trainings to them. We've opened up any kind of training that we offer to our providers and made it a shared training so we can start building those communities of practice across the sectors. We've talked a lot with each person about their collaboration and how our roles will work together. And then also looking at how we've looked at kindergarten transition and how this data can help that process. So the division worked a really long time on creating this really strong kindergarten transition program through their preschool development grant. And so we took what they found in that project and started looking at the elements and looked across all of those elements in the data we would soon be collecting to talk to our district partners about how we use that data in a meaningful way. We don't want our kids getting lost in the shuffle. And we have a really great opportunity right now to see a kid walk in at VPK and follow them all the way through. Hopefully one day we'll see them from birth and follow them all the way through. But right now we want to leverage that opportunity so that that kid and those families who really need us the most don't get lost in the shuffle. So I'm really excited about that work as well. Next steps, last slide, I promise. We're going to continue working on rule feedback. We also are really going to do a deep dive in technology so we have great feedback ready for our system development as the division embarks on that journey of changing the systems that we use to try to make that meet the new requirements. So we're working on getting an inventory of those changes. Once we find the final tools out for progress monitoring, we'll then step into, as Chancellor Mears mentioned, getting that training out in a really expeditious way so everyone feels successful in using that tool. We're going to really keep working on that collaboration with the district. I'm super excited about that. I think we've got some really great things going, as you'll hear in a moment. And then really keep that deep dive going into our low access communities so that, again, no child ever has a moment where they can't access a high quality VPK program or school readiness program as our ongoing work continues. But we're not going to let that go by and have a place where kids can't find where they need to a great place to start their learning opportunities off. So with that, I will pause for questions.
Members, any questions? Representative Koster, you're recognized. Vice Chair Koster, you're recognized.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you for being here. In some of the feedback that you've received, and in light of the fact that, you know, there is a more recent trend to recognize the importance of early learning, how can we help encourage, kind of alongside what Chancellor said in his encouragement and celebration of these teachers, of these early learning professionals, how can we, not necessarily as a legislative body, but as individuals in our districts, how can we help celebrate and support these people to start the shift from it's a job to I'm an early learning professional? What can we do?
First off, let's be friends, because that would take a long time, but I'm happy to give tons of feedback on that. But second, I would say keep us in the conversation. We are the first education in Florida, and I personally always will say I think we're the most important, but everybody has their own opinions about that. But I've lived this world for so long. I think if we get this part of education right, you spend less money on interventions later. I mean, we all know that studies, this is where you invest to get the most return on your investment. So keep us in the conversation. When you think education, think early learning. When you think, how do I start to make sure that we close achievement gaps, think infants. Think the moment that they're alive, we can start educating them, and that comes from strong relationships with teachers, strong relationships with families, and we should always be a part of that conversation. You have an early learning coalition in every part of the state. Go visit providers, see what they do, understand the components of it, so that when you are looking at policy, you see the importance of including us in that. And then I know, as I was a teacher and a director, when you say things like you've heard on the floor mentioned earlier, what it feels like to be in a classroom and represented, see Chair Lupus cry on the floor, things like that, it just means so much. So acknowledge it, but just keep us in the conversation. I know that's simple, but I'm happy to help with that along the way if you need us. Last time I'll mention it, I promise.
Thank you for bringing it up twice. Representative Caruso.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Director Smelter. Your excitement for what you do is also very apparent, and we appreciate that. You stated that you gathered data and had various analysis of current practices. Could you highlight how the association has used the data to plan for implementation in the classroom?
Yeah, absolutely. So when I talked about, so first looking at a staff analysis, when we did this for school readiness, we built capacity for all care levels of, this is a little in the weeds, but a little bit, let me start over. Take two. The tool has three different care levels, and so we did a lot of work to make sure that as we now have this extensive pre-K measurement that's going to happen, we looked at our numbers to make sure that we had enough staff, how much training would have to happen, so our training plans are set and not surprising us as this rolls out. But there is actually a thing that the division created. It's a study that was out of the University of Florida called the Florida Index for Childcare Access. It only looks at school readiness right now, but it was able to show us data that identifies areas in the state where we don't have a lot of capacity and also don't have capacity for high-quality programs. That was a good indicator for us to dig a little deeper in those communities that have highlighted it. So we've used that study across the state to dig into those communities and see where, is that the same thing in both programs? Likely is the same thing in both programs. So if we have low capacity in SR, it's likely we would also see low access to quality in VPK. So we've used that data to design those intervention plans as we see where we need to highlight certain, really, it's not even about counties or zip codes, it's down to the community level to make sure that no matter what street you live on, we're aware of what the struggles are for a person to be able to drop their child off somewhere that they feel safe and be able to go to work and take their mind off of that. So we've really made an effort to dig into that data as well. So we design really good intervention programs around the communities. Those are a few.
Thank you.
Can I just follow up on that? So the ramp and the chancellor was talking about this. So the ramp up of the implementation of class in VPK, what is the lift? Because we're already, we've implemented in SR. My guess is probably 3/4 of VPK providers are providing SR. So what does that ramp up really look like? Is it a significant lift? Is it less of a significant lift because the foundation's already been set? Could you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, absolutely. We're still actually calculating the percentage of the lift right now, so I'm happy to follow up once I have that all compiled. The difference between the VPK change versus school readiness is in school readiness we do a half of the classrooms in a care level, where VPK is all. So it may look like one age group was added, but it may add 7 or 8 classrooms that may be more than the total of half of every care level and the other care levels. So it depends on the provider and the community and how the structures of the programs are, but I'm really happy to follow up with that once we've compiled it. But you are right. I'd have to check with the chancellor, but I think our overlap is around 70% maybe. They can get those numbers better where they were already duly contracted, but whether or not they had an assessment was contingent on some other factors. So we're happy. I can work with the division and we can follow up with that data.
Representative McCurdy, you're recognized.
Thank you, Chair Lupus. Good morning. I just have a quick question about the limited access areas in the state. And I just wanted to know, was there, from your perspective, is there any type of resemblance in these areas that have lower access? Or is it kind of random? Or do you see some specific indicators in these areas throughout the state?
Yeah, Absolutely. There are a lot of variables that you can link across it, but I would say a very common denominator that we find are our lower resource communities. Because the communities can't afford to pay for higher quality care, they have to sacrifice elements of quality to be able to keep their doors open. And so for our lower resource communities, those are areas where we want to make sure that they have some sort of, to Chancellor Mayer's point, some stabilization brought into their world. Because if a family can only afford to pay $20 a day for an infant, that's all that provider can charge in that community. And so we work really hard to make sure that those communities have extra resources. But it is more likely in communities where they can't afford the $18 an hour staff who have a lot of training and expertise.
Just a follow-up comment. Thank you for that response. And just as I wanted to say, as a father of a soon-to-be four-year-old, I pay more attention to VPK programs in my district, and I do see a better quality. So I just want to say thank you.
Awesome. Thank you. I'm so happy to hear that.
Awesome. Well, Director Smeltzer, thank you so much. Members, I would just say this. If you don't have a relationship with your Early Learning Coalition director, you should have one. And Aaron is an incredible asset in terms of making that relationship, you know, building that relationship. And take the time, you know, in the weeks between committee weeks to go visit some of the child care centers, because I think you'd be amazed at some of the challenges that they're experiencing. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
All right, members, we're moving into the final portion of our meeting. We have Diana Fetterman, the Assistant Superintendent of Teaching and Learning for the School District of Palm Beach County. You are recognized. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you so much. It is an absolute, it's my privilege to be here today with you. All right, thank you, Chair Lupus and committee members for having me here. As was stated, my name is Diana Fetterman, and I am the proud Assistant Superintendent of Teaching and Learning for the School District of Palm Beach County. And it is my privilege to share our story with the implementation of the Quality Improvement Program here with you today. And I say our very purposefully, because it is truly our. And I just don't mean our in the school district. I mean our as in the district and the Early Learning Coalition, because this truly has been a collaboration and a relationship between the two partners. We could not have done this alone, quite literally. I want to tell you a little bit of history here. This started more than 15 years ago, this partnership for a quality improvement system, because we've all recognized how truly important, as the Chancellor said, early education is for the students in our district. The Children's Services Council inside of Palm Beach County brought together a lot of outside community or a lot of outside partners, the school district, the ELC, to all work together to really brainstorm how we could improve early education in both our public school system and with our private providers. And we were really excited to engage in those conversations, as was the ELC. And that's really what started the strong relationship that we see here today between the district and the ELC. Fast forward to 2015, and that is when we started using the class assessment system in order to really monitor the quality of the programming within our school district. Now, of course, as you know, in the legislative session, we moved forward to using the class assessment system as part of our school readiness contracts, where we know that our classrooms had to meet a certain threshold score in order to get a school readiness contract. So that really forced us with the ELC to truly deepen our relationship and work together even more closely. And here's why that was really important. Just using the system had us working together to implement, because our ELC partners came into our school buildings in order to utilize and implement the class system, to really monitor for those classroom interactions, as the Chancellor talked about, to look for those teacher team and student interactions, to look at the classroom environment, to look at all those aspects of the educational system. But where the relationship was really the most important is what happens when we don't meet those scores, because that's going to happen. We have had three schools that failed to meet the number needed for the school readiness contract. It will happen. And that's when you need the relationship between the district and the ELC the most, because we have to work together to improve the quality of education within our programs. Because as was stated, that is the most important thing we can have, is a strong early childhood education program. So what happened with those three schools? Our ELCs made sure to implement a quality improvement plan. They worked with us in the school district to implement coaching and modeling, professional learning for our teachers over the course of several months to really improve what was happening in those classrooms and in those schools for our early childhood programs. And I'm very, very proud to say, after those several months, they redid the class assessment system. All three of those programs passed. In fact, one of them passed with scores high enough that we were able to earn a two-year school readiness contract. It really, really came down to the close relationship we had to make that work. Because as we all know, right, relationships are great when things are going well. But when there's a problem, that's when you really need a strong relationship. And I'm so incredibly grateful for the relationship we've really brokered over those years with our ELC to make this work. So I want to just talk about some sample ways you can make this work. And the graphic here really does that. I know that the print there could work like an eye test if you needed to. Focus on the circles in the middle. I think that really it takes that up. What you can see there is the cadence between the ELC and the school district. It really requires each partner to have a role. Now, the school district and ELC came together to decide who was going to have which role, who was going to talk with whom, and how it was going to work. But once that was established, each partner took their role and moved accordingly. And that's important. In order to have this process work, each partner has to understand this is the role and here's how it's going to work through. What I also want you to notice is a very deliberate decision. You know who's not in those circles? The individual schools. Because that's an impossibility. It's an impossibility to ask the ELCs to communicate individually with each schools. First, it's a lot. And secondly, our schools are busy running, right? Our schools are working hard each and every day. That is the role of the district to communicate with the ELC, to set that level of cadence and collaboration, and then we communicate individually with our principals. We as a school district communicate individually with our teaching teams to make the process run smoothly. And we work as the liaison with the ELC and the schools. Three things that you can see there, and I've talked a little bit, the importance of the roles, the absolute importance of communication. Because when you have strong relationships, right, it all comes down to communication. You have to have constant, ongoing communication with the partners. In fact, I want to say one of the most exciting parts about this relationship that we've had is Erin referred to me as a board member a few minutes ago. 2 years ago, I was incredibly honored to be asked to be a board member of the ELC. So I've been a proud board member of our local ELC in all my spare time as an assistant superintendent. I've also been serving as a board member, and I'm incredibly proud to do that because it is such important work. But I also want to talk about this last one, flexibility. We both partners have to be flexible. As two organizations, each organization have their own protocols, right? Their own ways of work, their own rules, their own established cadences. That's normal. And those protocols don't always align, which means each partner has to be flexible and also has to understand where the other partner cannot necessarily be flexible. For instance, when we had those three schools that didn't make the initial school readiness cutoff score, and we had to implement all of the professional learning for our educators as was required, we still at the same time have teachers that have association contracts, right? And we have to make sure we follow all the times of those contracts and when they can work. So our ELC worked with us to make sure that when we offered the professional learning, when we offered all of the extra duty times and the extra coaching, that we also did it in line with all of the association contracts. So that required a lot of flexibility on behalf of both partners to work together, but they recognize the importance of that. We still had to follow rules, but at the same time, they recognize that we had to do it within line with the association contracts, right? But they got that. They understood that. they did it because there was that history of working together. I also want to say this, and this is not something that's written on there, but it was stated today by all my colleagues up here on the panel, and it's something that I want to note because it's so incredibly important. This works. It works in Palm Beach County for one reason, and I truly believe it can work in every single district in our state for this reason right here. Because at the end of the day, whether it's the ELC, the Children's Services Council, or school district, we all want the same thing. We want to improve early childhood education for every single student that lives within our school district boundaries, that lives within our counties, that live within our state. Right? Because we know that if we do that, if our students walk into our doors then when they come into kindergarten, into the K-12 system, right, we lower the needs for intervention. We improve the quality of education when they walk in the door. It improves so many of their educational aspects and all of the opportunities that they have moving forward. So no matter what other aspects we have to work around, no matter what other challenges we might face in this relationship, we all have that as our number one. And I can truly state, I believe that's true for the number one for every single school district in the state and for all the ELCs in the state. And because of that, I believe everyone can find a way to work together on this one.
Thank you so much. Members, any questions? You've shocked them. Oh, Representative Caruso, of course. You're recognized.
I wasn't going to speak up, but thank you, Chair. Didn't want to let the opportunity go by, and I wanted to thank you, Superintendent Fetterman, for your presentation and for your great work back home in Palm Beach County, Delray Beach, and I've been excited to visit the center, the school, and read to the kids, and what you've got going on there blew my mind. And a question, you mentioned that three schools failed to qualify for the readiness program, and you turned them around and got them all to qualify in one for a two-year contract, which is outstanding. Do you have any of those recommendations that you can share to the other school districts? And if you what could you highlight just a couple of those things?
You recognize.
Thank you. It was a lot of working together, professional learning, coaching. It was the quality improvement plan that our ELC laid out, which was a step-by-step plan for that coaching, that mentoring, that quality improvement. Our own school district also has coaches that in our early childhood program, which we put into those classrooms and really assisted those teaching teams in order to work together. Also communication with our teachers to make sure that they recognize, like, this is not an evaluation tool, as Chancellor said, it's not an evaluation tool of our teachers. This is about the interactions between the adults and the students. So it was about communication, it was about the professional learning, and it was about recognizing that this is just improving what's happening. It's quality improvement.
Great. Thank you.
And closing it out will be Ranking Member Davis in the final 90 seconds.
Really, really quickly. On one of your slides, it mentioned the ELC sent valid and reliable assessors. I only wanted to know, who are the assessors?
You recognize?
Yes, if I can bring that to Aaron.
So every ELC has a training to make sure that the staff that came out to do that work and the staff that we have locally have gone through the training to be considered reliable in the class tool. They also get calibrated every year, sometimes more than once a year, to make sure that our opinions don't bleed into the assessment, but that we are measuring in exact accordance with the tool. So those would be the reliable assessors.
Awesome. Thank you. Thank you so much, Assistant Superintendent Fetterman. We have a number, I know Representative Learned had some questions. You may have some more questions from the committee, but we are running out of time. To all of our presenters, thank you so much. As you can tell, this is the best committee in the Florida House, so we appreciate you being with us today. And seeing no further business before the committee, Representative Duggan moves, we rise.